Ladies and gentlemen, on this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with the writer and director and star of Rogue Warrior Robot Fighter. Next.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Hey everybody, Frank Moran here for iTalkMovies. This is the show where we get up close and personal with the people that bring you all that great entertainment that you get to see, whether you're going to the movie theaters, maybe you're watching it at home, on your mobile streaming devices. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, my guests today have a new film that just came out. In fact, they had the premiere on this past Friday. It is Rogue Warrior Robot Fighter. We have the star, Tracy Birdsall, and the writer and director, Neil Johnson, joining us right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
All right. So let's, we'll talk about the film in just a moment here. But I just wanted to backtrack a little bit here for your respective starts. So, Tracy, are you a Los Angeles native?
I was born in Burbank. I don't have a great story. Like, all actors have these great stories and how they ended up here and stuff. I was born in Burbank.
Oh, nice. So, so then right up here, being so close to the industry, was it already from growing up, like, this is something that I really want to be doing? Or is it come a little bit later?
You know, I always knew that I wanted to do it. And I remember being a little kid and holding my mom's hand and people telling her in the grocery store, oh, you should get her in the movies and she's so outgoing. And I sang and I danced and everything. My mom was like, no, she has to use her brain. No, she shouldn't do that. So I kind of had to struggle to get into it. Like, my parents are super supportive now. Mm-hmm. But as a little kid, that really wasn't what they saw their daughter doing, you know. But it's just, I love to perform and I love to entertain and I love to take on identities. And so it was just, it was a struggle, but I did it.
Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have two older sisters.
And are they also in the entertainment industry?
No. I have a great-grandfather who was a famous Disney composer, so Albert Lewis, all the way back in the 30s, Steamboat Willie and all that stuff. But besides that, that's the only other person in the industry.
Wow, but yeah. Still, that is really cool. So did you grow up partial to Disney then?
I did. My mom has all these stories about sitting on the original Donald Duck's lap, and she used to watch her grandfather compose things and stuff. So we had all this memorabilia all over the house. But it was really cool. So it was like, it always felt really close. I had no idea how hard it was going to be. You know, tons of studying and just climbing up those ranks and stuff like that. But yeah, everything was Disney in my life.
And Neil, how about yourself? Where are you from originally?
I'm British. So I was born in England and I grew up partially in Australia. So I have a couple of accents and I moved to New York in 99. And, you know, it's all I've ever done is make movies. Since the age of two. So, you know, and I was basically a science fiction nut from the age of two because I saw Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. And then around the same time, there was Star Trek and Doctor Who. And I mean, it knocked my brain around.
So when something like Star Wars comes along, since you'd already been kind of exposed to, you know, the moon landing, mm-hmm. Doctor Who, Star Trek, did Star Wars have a huge impact on you? Or it's like, oh, this is a really cool addition to stuff I already was passionate about?
Well, at the age of six, I read The Time Machine. And then I mean, that's an adult book for a, you know, a young person. And then I followed that up with War of the Worlds, which was a little harder to read. And so I was already into heavy sci-fi. And before Star Wars, obviously, you know, there was like Silent Running, Logan's Run. 2001 I hadn't seen because it was kind of before my time. And just Star Trek. So Star Wars came out. It was just fell in naturally for me. But I think Star Wars showed me that you could actually make a movie and that somebody was behind the film and somebody wrote it. I mean, I was writing stories before I saw Star Wars and you know, books. And I wrote my first novel at the age of 10. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's something you just become. And as I said, then Star Wars came out and it's like, okay, this is how it's done. And I learned everything on how to make that movie. From there, I just, you know, realized that you've just got to find your own path. And I would love to remake Star Wars over and over again because nothing would make me happier. But, but I'm, you know, for me, it's all about real science, and that's what really, really gets me excited. But you know, just when I have a day off, I watch Star Wars.
Well, certainly when you look at Star Trek, I think when it works best, especially I think, and especially in science fiction, is when you can take present day problems, but then use a futuristic take on them to really kind of explore these issues that sometimes you can't fully explore, especially given the time period that they were telling these stories. you couldn't fully explore if you're trying to tell a present day story.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, is like with yourself as well. You were brought up on Star Trek pretty heavily, weren't you, Tracy?
Yeah, my dad was a Star Trek junkie. I always tell the story that we'd sit there and eat Rocky Road ice cream after we'd all go to bed, and we'd sneak back up, and he'd let us join him and watch Star Trek over and over and over again, yeah.
So when the series is canceled, then it comes back for the motion picture. Was your dad like, all right, everybody, let's go. We're going to the movie theater. We're checking out Star Trek, the motion picture.
You know, not really. I think by that point we were already kind of, you know, doing things on our own, you know. So he's a big junkie of watching science fiction still. But, you know, we were already off watching it with our friends and stuff by then. But we come back and we chat about it, you know.
How did he enjoy Star Trek, the motion picture? Because even as much of a Star Trek fan as I am, that's still... Mm-hmm. Whew, it's not exactly the...
Yeah, it was a tough one, wasn't it?
It was a tough one, yeah. It was a tough one.
I mean, you know, it was Robert Wise directed it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's he should have done a more interesting job. And I think, you know what, I think the problem with Star Trek motion picture was, it's kind of like the curse of digital. Because once digital comes out, you know, everybody can do a digital movie. Everything's green screen. Let's do all this fake stuff. And, you know, it kind of gets dated. And Star Trek, the motion picture, is the same thing. Oh, we got to do sci-fi. Let's do all the visual effects. You know, we know now how to do good visual effects because of Star Wars. So they were just kind of riffing on that whole visual effects thing.
I think, too, like when it came out to the motion picture, like when we were kids, science fiction was thinking so far in the future, you know, and there were things that we could kind of imagine, you know, it was taking Inspector Gadget to a whole new level, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that with the new Star Trek movie, when it came to motion picture, that it wasn't that unbelievable and it wasn't that creative to me. Like, I like to think of, oh, what could be, but it has to be believable. It has to almost be science. Like, if you look at a lot of things we have now, like I have my iWatch on, you know, and those were things that were in old science fiction things, like, oh my God, that'd be so cool.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
It's like, but we didn't look at a lot of the thing. You know, I don't know. It's just, it has to be one of those things that challenges your mind, makes you think outside the box, makes you think, oh, in the future, this could be possible.
See, it was like, when Star Trek II came out, mm-hmm. now that just captured our and that's the thing I like about Star Wars. It's about the adventure and the characters.
Yeah.
And Star Trek II was like, okay, let's get serious now about having some fun, mm-hmm. and having a real adventure. And start, you know, the Wrath of Khan was actually seminal for me.
I loved that.
And that's my favorite.
Oh, I loved that.
It gives me goosebumps. Like I say, I get goosebumps even talking about it.
Mm-hmm. That for me, it's like, it's so easily quotable. There's just so many great moments and so many great lines of dialogue in that film. Mm. And just given, certainly the... In a sense where they had a much more limited budget to work with. Yeah. I mean, after the first film didn't do so well, and just to see what they're able to achieve when you just are kind of confined in a smaller box, and what you have to come up and just be really ingenious in the way that you can kind of maximize what you've got to tell the story that you want to tell.
And the characters were so rich. Yes. To me, I love watching a film that's all about the characters. To me, I have to get lost in that story. And I just thought that was...
Oh, and you were friends with Ricardo Montalban as well.
I worked with him.
Yeah, so...
Get out of town.
I did.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
On... Guy, what was it? Hearts Are Wild. Yeah, in Las Vegas. It was a TV series.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how was Ricardo?
He's amazing.
He seems like just like a classic gentleman.
He's just such a nice guy. And he was dealing with some health issues at the time, you know, because it was in his, you know, later years. But it was fascinating how he dealt with them and how he just took everything like a man. And there's this scene where he's walking up the front stairs to the casino. And he literally had to do like one step and then the other foot had to come up. But they didn't show that in the film because they did it one way and then the other. So when you see him going up the stairs, a lot of it's from here up. And he just dealt with it. He didn't complain. And he was so polite. And I've worked with a lot of great people and I love that about them. I love seeing what they're like. It's like, oh, what would it be like to be you? You know? It's like...
So when you are, you decide like, all right, I really want to make a go at this. Mm-hmm. And are your parents initially like, oh boy, I don't know, Tracy, are you sure you should be doing this?
This is a terrible thing to say here, but I actually had to sign my parents' names to my union paperwork when I was 15. Because my first union job was a Sunkist soda commercial. Everybody's got to start somewhere. And those ran for 10 years. And I just remember like I had to go down to the union office and I didn't think that they were going to be supportive of it. And so I did. And I wasn't that kid. You know, I was a really honest kid, you know.
And then your parents turned on the television.
And my parents turned on the television, and that's how they found out.
Wow. Awesome that you were able to keep that under wraps for that long.
Yeah.
Until the sun kissed the commercial came on.
That's our daughter.
I mean, they were really supportive. I did a lot of musical theater, and I did a lot of things with school, and I took a lot of classes and studied and stuff. But that was the point, and they're like, oh, this is the direction she's going in, you know? And then it was kind of, you know, full steam ahead, yeah.
Wow. Were you with them when they first saw that commercial?
Or is it no, just like but I was in the house.
Tracy Lee.
Tracy Lee.
We just saw this, and there's no DVR or anything like that, so they can't just like rewind it instantly.
No,
like,
and the worst thing was is like every commercial that came on, anybody looked anything like me. Did you do this one too? Did you? And I was like, no. You know, like, I would have told you. You know? Yeah. But.
So when you decided just to stay here in Los Angeles, at any time in terms of pursuing acting, you ever think like, hey, maybe I want to go try New York for a little while and just see what it's like on the other side of the coast?
Oh, yeah. I lived in New York for a while. I used to work on a soap called Loving. And then I worked in Chicago for a while. I lived in Alaska and did some stuff out there. I've kind of hopped around. I lived in the East Bay for a little while. I moved out there for a project for the remake of Streets of San Francisco. And then the director got sick. And as everybody knows, he eventually died and the project crumbled. But I always come back to L.A. You know, I mean, this is kind of where my peeps are. This is kind of home for me. Yeah.
So Loving, of course, that was one of the soaps there where it was right before All My Children.
Yeah.
Wasn't yes. Yeah. So I mean, certainly I feel like going through any actor that has gone through working on a soap opera, I mean, I feel like they've really got a chance to really hone their craft, because just the demands that are placed on an actor, just the amount of dialogue that you have to be able to deliver.
Tough, isn't it?
Well, what's funny is you get your script the night before and they show up to your dressing room and you get makeup, and that's really fun. I mean, because on soaps, I mean, they pamper you like crazy. They're doing your arms and legs. They're doing everything, right? And then right before you go out on set, of course, the papers come under the door. And it's like, oh, this has all been changed, you know. But I'm really good with dialogue. Like, I really am. So it wasn't that bad. But what I like about doing these, you know, deep characters in film is I like delving really deep into a character. And with soap, you've created your character. They only have so much room that they can go, you know, 10 degrees this way, 20 degrees that way. And so that's one of the reasons I think I like film so much, is because you get to just spend months creating these characters and deciding where they're going to go and deciding what their tics are and their little things. And it's just so much fun for me to get inside, you know.
So, Neil, for you, in speaking of film, so do you start doing your own films in the UK before you move over to New York?
It's a funny story. So I was in England, and I was just writing to myself, and then to Australia, where I was living with my family. My father decided to build a ship, or a boat, in the back garden, which Tracy...
Which is kind of funny, because my dad built a boat in our backyard, too. When we met, we told each other that story. It's like, no.
Yeah.
But my dad finished his.
Yeah. Your dad did not?
No. Well, he was a sea captain, so captain of a big ship.
Okay.
Like big ones. And I took that boat and rebuilt it into a spaceship. And then I got a Super 8 camera, and, you know, then video cameras came around. I got into film school, all that sort of stuff. So I was kind of on that path, you know, and I couldn't do anything else. You know, I tried other jobs, you know, while I was at film school, and it just, I'm not very good at other things. I'm not even great at making movies, to be honest with you, but I love it so much. No, but I really love it, you know, and that's the thing. That's the difference. It's really, you know, it'd be a wasted life to do anything else, because it's my passion. But I was, you know, I did a bunch of music videos, and I mean, I was a director at 21, and it's just hard work. It sounds very glamorous, and I didn't know anybody in the industry. I had no help. In fact, I had a lot of negativity. A lot of people, especially in Australia, because I was British and I had an accent back then, you know, British accent, and people were actually really kind of rude to me, shall we say, or I would say racist, but, you know, it was just, I was different, and so people would, you know, that would pick on you or do this or that, and that's okay. You know, I became stronger as a result of that. But, you know, when you're put into these moments of adversity, you find your passion and you just gravitate towards that. So I would escape. I'd build a spaceship, then I'd escape on a journey, and I'd go on an adventure somewhere. And this is all pre-Star Wars, but it would like Star Wars adventures. And then Star Wars came out, and I saw it kind of changed the journeys. But it was always about time travel and going to outer space and having a little spaceship. So That was my whole life, and I was only happy in that world. And when I got back to the reality of growing up in Australia in a kind of a rough area, it wasn't fun, you know. So you have to have something, and that's, you know, even now I'm just happy. And then, you know, made first feature film, you know, second feature film. People in Australia were not very supportive of me, shall we say. And that's okay, because I was doing commercial stuff and not cultural stuff as they wanted me to do. And then George Lucas came to the Screen Producers Association. I'd just done my first feature film, and I did it all digital. And it was the world's first widescreen, anamorphic digital feature film ever made with visual effects. And everyone said, oh, you should have done, you know, this is the late 90s. You should have done 35mm. You're an idiot, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, George Lucas said, you know, he actually mentioned me and, you know, mentioned my name and said digital is the future at the Screen Producers Association. And Rip McCallum, who was the producer of, you know, episode 1, 2, and 3, wanted to talk. And we just grilled me with questions. And it was like, you know, George is a short guy. Mm-hmm. But I was so inspired by the fact that, you know, this little guy, who's a really nice guy, mm-hmm. and very humble and very funny, made Star Wars and made this $2 billion empire. So I was really quite impressed with this fact that, you know, it all came out of here. And it was such an empowering moment. And so from, you know, that moment on, I just said, well, okay, I'm on my own tangent. It's definitely a journey I was meant to walk. And I don't know where it's going to end up, you know. And I've done, I think, 14 feature films. The one thing about me is, you know, I've started without any help. No money, nothing. And everything's getting better and better. And the budgets are getting, I won't say getting bigger. They're just evolving with mm-hmm. the film. But the films are getting better. And, you know, eventually I'll make the perfect film. So, you know, I've got the worst reputation as a director in the high-end science fiction film industry because people think my work's, you know, a little bit funny. But it's only just because of what it is and where you've come from. And as long as you improve. I mean, look at Peter Jackson's first movie. I mean, they're pretty bad. And, you know, I'm just one of those people who just gets better with age, I think, as far as my work.
It's a journey. It's a journey.
Do you think that you could ever direct the perfect film? Yes. I feel like that... Really, that you feel like there would not be that saying that there is zero, that there's nothing that you, there's not the way you exactly want it. Like it's an impossible goal to achieve.
Well, you see, you know, it's funny. I think about this day and night, and I go through this because I, you know, I'm a big Stanley Kubrick fan and a David Lynch fan. And for me, the perfect film could be Eraserhead. But for David Lynch, it's not perfect. You know, mm-hmm. Star Wars, you could say it could be a perfect film. But George Lucas was so unhappy with that movie. And I get it, you know, and one of my best love movies I'm very unhappy with as well. I wish I was rushed, and it's always the case, you know, you always rush and you always want to improve. And I, you know, I,
you weren't rushed with Rogue Warrior though.
No, I wasn't,
which was kind of nice.
Yeah,
we spent way too much time on that movie. but we just kept reshooting. If something wasn't perfect, it's like, let's go do it again. Yeah. The location wasn't epic enough. Let's go do it again. I mean,
and she suffered because of my perfectionism.
Well, speaking of that, because we have a Rogue Warrior, a robot fighter. Mm-hmm. So for this, it takes place in a post-apocalyptic future where now it's kind of figuring out the relationship. AI is kind of taken over and they're looking to exterminate mankind, not just on Earth, but on other planets as well.
Exactly.
So what was the inspiration for this story?
I was trying to be original as much as possible, in the sense that when you delve into the backstory of the film, it's really about the problems of merging man with machine. And that's the real hidden message, shall we say, underneath that. But I mean, you know, how it plays out in the movie is another story. But it's, you know, when we were shooting the movie, Force Awakens came out. And it was almost like shot for shot. The trailer was our film, and their film was almost exactly the same. It's like, why does this happen to me?
We even changed one of the things, because I actually had two speeder bikes in Rogue Warrior at first. And then when we saw that...
Yeah. She was a speeder bike junkie in the film originally.
I am a speeder bike junkie. Yeah, because of growing up with a fascination with all those things. Yeah. You know, so it's like, oh my God, I get to ride a speeder bike.
That's it.
And I just about got killed doing it, too.
Really?
I mean, because he wants to make everything as practical as possible. So we're out there in the desert. We did it over and over and over. We tried green screen. It wasn't real enough. So they put the speeder bike on the back of a flatbed of a truck, and they strapped this thing down, and I've got to get on top of it, and they're just... beating around and going in circles. Well, of course, the only thing not strapped down was me, right?
And I just said, hold on. I
was hanging on for dear life, but it was so real. You know, so since I believed it was real, yeah. and I can go there in my head on a speeder bike because I've watched all these movies, you know. But that was the one thing I was like, if I fall off of this. I mean, there are a lot of things, if I fall, at least I wouldn't break something. But I would have broken something for sure, yeah.
So you write the script, and then is the first time that you two kind of come in contact with each other is when you read the script, or had you known each other before?
Oh, no. We knew each other. I did a couple of voiceover roles for him. I'm a sci-fi junkie, and so we met, and he's like, oh, well, do you want to do this voice? I'm like, of course I want to do that computer voice. I mean, it's like, you know, I never got to work in sci-fi before. It's always been drama and comedy. And And so then he saw my, I was winning awards for other films that I was doing, and he saw my commitment level and how hard I worked and stuff. He goes, okay, we gotta get a project together. And so my love for robotics and science fiction, and he went through his scripts, and so we kind of took something that we both were really fascinated with and that I wanted to bring to life. And so he kind of morphed one of his scripts into that. And then once it got cast, he rewrote the whole thing all over again, because our characters all have, you know, they all have their interpersonal relationships, but they're also, they're such good actors that he wanted to make sure that the roles were meaty enough for them too, in order to best utilize their talents too.
Yeah, we threw away at least 1 hour's worth of finished film.
Yeah.
Rogue Warrior. So, wow. And that's a lot.
It was sad. I look at injuries and stuff. Oh my God, I went through everything for that. And then it's like, goodbye.
Is that an easy thing for you to make those decisions on, or is it tough to, as they say, kill your babies?
It used to be hard. Mm-hmm. And now it's all about, wow, I wish I could have cut more out, you know, because you kind of, you're making it's like you're building a sports car, and you want it to be streamlined, and you want it to go fast, and you want it to just, you know, push through as much as possible. So, you know, with every sports car, they always throw out the back seat firstly, and then there's something else and something else. And we're going through this again right now with the movie The Time War, which I guess we actually shot before Rogue Warrior.
The principal photography, but then we've shot many, many, many weeks, even 3 weeks in England since principal photography.
Oh, wow.
20 days in the UK.
We go to the UK, right? And he goes, if you'll come out here, he goes, and we'll shoot some of the movie, and then I'll show you around. Well, we ended up shooting 20 out of 21 days that I was there. I only had one day off, so I went to Cardiff and saw the Doctor Who Experience.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
How was that?
I was like a little kid. I even got grumpy because he was trying to distract me for something, and I was just like a little kid. It was like, just stay out of my space. I'm having a moment here, you know?
too many Daleks, you know.
Oh, I was just so overwhelmed. It's amazing.
So Neil, for you that you know, you watch Star Wars, many science fiction films. You have Star Trek, Doctor Who, but Star Wars, in terms of just like, you know, in creating ILM for all that, the effects that they're able to achieve in that. For you as a filmmaker, as you say, the budgets are getting bigger, but still, I assume what you want to achieve on screen, you're still kind of wrestling how to bring that with the budgets that you're working with.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I always dreamed of a day, and I remember in the early 90s I dreamed of digital, and I know it sounds weird, but I had all these visions about it, and I thought one day there'll come a time when you can think it up and dream it and you can do it. And then Babylon 5 came out, and I was like, oh yes, it started. I had all these arguments with people. I said, look, one day there's not going to be any videotape, no film, it's all going to be on computer. And they said, no, it's impossible. And I was right. And, you know, that's what started me down that path. And I mean, it's the arrogance of youth at the time, because I was young. But, you know, I had a dream. And it's not that I created the digital world or anything. I mean, you know, there's a million people who actually figured it out, but I knew it was possible. And so we're now at a point where, at least for me, I feel you can almost, if you learn enough, and you can pretty much do anything you want in movies. If you can think it and dream it, you can make it. And this is unparalleled, because they couldn't do that when they did Star Wars. They had to figure out how to do it. And now we can do, I mean, you think of any idea you want to do, you can do it. And this is truly an amazing thing, and people aren't really sort of figuring that out. The danger is, oh, okay, we can do anything, so let's do anything. So let's let ourselves just go crazy and just make a big piece of popcorn. And that's nice, but you forget that what the audiences now want to see is not this glitz and glamour and these beautiful effects and everything else. They want to see humans reacting to other humans in strange situations. And that's what we love. That's why The Revenant was such an amazing movie.
Oh, I love The Revenant.
You know, and that's why we love great actors, because they bring to life something special. And it's not about somebody just representing, you know, the visual effect and reacting to it. That's terrible. And then I think that's probably why Wonder Woman has done so well. It just came out this week. It's because and they're not reacting to the visual effects.
Right.
People are reacting to the character of Wonder Woman and how good she is and how interesting and how, you know, and that's why we try to do with Rogue Warrior. It's you've seen the film. So, you know, we do have visual effects in the movie, but it's not about that. It's about the character Sienna's journey, and it's about what she goes through and how messed up she is by the end of the film and why, and, you know, where that leads you to and what that teaches you about yourself. And that's what I'm more interested in, is the human condition and what technology tells us about ourselves. And you know, we're in a golden age and we don't know it.
That's my thing too. It's like, for me, when I'm working with people, I don't want to work with actors that are acting. I want to work with people who are creating and living it. And so I have a trick question when we're talking to people and we're thinking of hiring them. And they'll hear this and they'll forget it, you know. But you're talking to an actor and you say, if you couldn't be an actor, what would you be doing? Well, I'd be doing, oh, and I have my degree. No, wrong answer. I can't imagine doing anything besides that. Those are the people you want to work with. The people that like live and breathe. And all I want to do is create these characters and live them. And that was so much fun with this film, was that everybody was living their role. Nobody was acting. And me as a viewer, that's what I want to see. I want to see something come to life in front of me. I don't want to see people going blah, 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 blah. I don't want to see theatrics. I don't want to see, you know, I want to see people living these characters so you get sucked into that journey.
Well, speaking of Sienna in the film, for a little over 7 minutes in the film, there's not a line of dialogue from you. You're basically, you're there interacting with this person, but you've got your face covered. But for the first seven minutes, we are just watching you just interact without anything said. Mm-hmm. So for you, when you read that, it's like pretty much the first 7 minutes, it's just going to be based on just your actions, the way you're looking with your eyes, the expression you're making. Mm-hmm. You see something like that, do you just like, all right, this is cool. It's a different way of me being able to show this character without using dialogue.
Well, to me, 90% of my character is not in her words. It can't be about what you're saying. So even when there's lines and things like that, to me, what I'm feeling is what shows across on my face. So if all I'm doing is living and breathing in that moment and you have to read through the eyes and the expressions, that's fun for an actor because you're just being, you know, and so it doesn't really matter. The lines I learn months before I create the character. So that when I find that character and exactly who they are, that the lines just come out. You know, it's situational. So, yeah, I don't mind that at all. I think that's amazing, you know, because I live and breathe for those moments that are in between the lines where you get to show something, you know. And to me, even watching, like we're talking about The Revenant earlier, you don't really know what he says. Nobody goes back in that movie and remembers a quote.
I couldn't tell you a single line from that film at all.
You remember the expressions. You remember what he was feeling. You remember knowing that he was really feeling that.
And he was freezing his ass off. You could tell.
I know what it's like now in the next movie. He put me out in England. It was 0 degrees and I have not enough clothes on. I'm covered. But I was freezing so much that when we got back, it took me 3 weeks before my forehead would relax. It was like, so I Googled it. I'm like, why won't my forehead relax? I've been in the cold. And it's apparently your body's warning signal to tell you that you're cold. So you're supposed to go inside, right? But we're outside filming day after day after day. 3 weeks.
Three.
I was like, you know? And I can see it in the footage. I'm like, look at my forehead.
Yeah.
And I never saw myself in film cold before. And I remember saying to him, I wonder what my cold face will look like, because I love looking at actors because they look terrible when they're freezing, right? But it's so fascinating because it's so real. They're really that cold. You know? So now you get to see my cold face.
All right. Because one thing at the beginning of that film is there's a dog in the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then when stuff happens at the beginning, I won't spoil everything, but then you take off. And I was like, I just left the dog. And then it does circle back around. I was like, oh, did they just... All right. But then you guys pulled it together.
We
like,
didn't
all right,
ditch
yes,
the dog.
No, didn't ditch the dog. Didn't ditch the dog. Got to keep the dog around.
Yeah.
It's a great dog.
So what I wanted to ask is just the landscapes for this. Where did you shoot the film?
Oh, boy.
Everywhere.
Yeah, it's all real location. And, you know, you'll see a couple of times the camera goes right up really high. And it's not CG. It's that is a real desert.
It's all real. They would literally drop me off and drive away, and it was so hot that I could just see the waves, like in the sand or in the desert, and I didn't even know where they were.
We had her on the helicopter, so we knew that if she fell, that you know we could run in and pick her up.
I only passed out once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So were these all, it was all helicopter shots for those, or did you use drones at all
both.
As well, too?
Both.
Okay.
We had a slight accident with the helicopter.
Had a slight accident with a lot of things. Crashed a lot of drones. A lot went wrong because we're dealing with the elements. You know, you've got sandstorms and you've got all this stuff going on and you can't control that.
Yeah, like back to your question, though, we shot in, Salton Sea, Yuma, Arizona. Mm-hmm. We shot in...
Trona Pinnacles,
Melt, which is where they shot Star Trek V.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, very cool.
And Tatooine is in Arizona.
Yeah, so where the Sarlacc pit was, we were filming the same zone.
Like, pretty cool, right?
That is very cool. Yes.
I was inspired, I have to tell you.
Do they have anything up there about like that this is where the Sarlacc pit is? Nobody
no,
like
no, we just know it's there.
Oh wow.
I mean the Sarlacc's probably buried somewhere in there, but you know, just these sort of places, and it's not about trying to copy, it's just that they're great locations because they look good. But we found new places, and there's places that aren't on the map. And but you know, I mean literally you just get in the truck and you drive off-road for an hour with the trucks. And, you know, we just have a team of people. We kept driving. We did a location survey first into the middle of nowhere. And that's why when the camera goes out high,
there's nothing around.
There is nothing around. Wow. And it's the no man's land of California mostly. And a little bit in Australia.
Bribie Island
in Australia. Yeah.
Melbourne, Brisbane.
Yeah. Just wherever we could find that looked like another planet. And I mean, because we wanted to create some sort of sense of, you know, of being off world. So it was real. And when you saw there was a point with this big sandstorm near the end of the film, that was a real sandstorm. And I did destroy a drone in that sandstorm, but I got the footage.
And wow. I could hardly even walk in it. My ears, my eyes, everything was full of sand. Yeah. It's like, just walk that way. I just walk. But it's good for the character.
Yeah.
You know, it's like those are really the challenges that character's going through. I'm like, okay.
And then we had the parachute stuff at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, she parachutes out of the spaceship. We had a real parachute thingy. Mm-hmm. Set up, which was, you know, it's real, but you can see it's real.
Yeah.
But doing some of that footage or some of the pickup shots for that, it was early days of drones, and I was flying a drone, and the wind caught it, and it got caught in the branch of a tree or something, and it just went straight into the Malibu Mountains, you know, straight down. I said, oh, okay, I'll get it. And, you know, this is Tracy came out for that day as well, so, because it was, were we just shooting aerials that day, or was it just something?
Remember.
Anyway,
yeah.
So I ran out. After the drone, I realized it had landed in a...
At first I heard footprints. Like I could hear like a big cat or something. And I'm like yelling to him. I'm like, I hear something out there in the bushes. What is it, right? Because we've got everything from bobcats and mountain lions and everything out there. So anyway,
I was in a bobcat nest. And
he got a picture of it.
Actually, I got three. But see, the thing was getting in there, because the drone was still running. I could hear it. And mm-hmm. I leapt into the thing. You know, you forget because the drone's sitting there. It's going to, you know. So I ran in there and I cut myself to shreds. I mean, there's blood all over my legs because I didn't dress properly for the occasion.
Of course not.
And then I saw the bobcat covered in blood, you know, and I was just dripping with blood. And he was staring at me, and
he was like,
oh.
And I just got out really quick.
Yeah.
But I got photos of everything, mm-hmm. you know, so I just kept documenting the whole thing.
That's incredible.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
It's like he had me climbing this mountain in this new movie, and we're out there, and he's, you know, I could hardly get up the mountain. I'm like scaling on all fours, you know. I mean, it's snow and everything else, and there's bear poo everywhere, right? And I'm like, you really
I didn't
want
know
me
it
to,
was bear poo.
Yeah. It's like, I really don't want to put my hands in it, you know, but I was trying to hang on and not slide down the snow. And
so you put your hands in. You got to do what you got to do to be able to keep crawling up that.
Definitely rolled in it, that's for sure.
He said action.
Yeah, so you got to do it.
You just got to keep going, you know, but he's like, well, how do you know it's bear poo? I'm like, well, I did live in Alaska for a while. That's bear poo.
Oh,
I know. You do what you got to do.
Yeah, because the shots in there are just so incredible, and they really just paint the picture that this is just, you know, civilization is basically on the decline.
Yeah.
For this.
Well, it was, and that's what I like about the film. Visually, it's like a painting,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'm very proud of the look of it. But it's like a Matisse painting. It's got
very
a certain
artistic,
certain coloring to it, you know, and it's different from other things I've done. And we're on the Time War at the moment, which is it's all about dark blues and reds.
It's totally different than,
you know, it's Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
With time travel,
it's dark.
But you know, it's nice to have a contrast, you know, and that's everything. You know, it's like when you do a painting, you want to do a certain type. You don't throw every color on. You say, okay, I want to choose certain colors, and I do that with every movie. I have certain colors I use, and Rogue Warrior was a lot of whites, grays, yellows, I'm trying to think what else, but you know, and a bit of blue here and there. But it was a certain texture, and that's kind of, you know, how we sort of created the world, shall we say. It's all about colorization, and with Time War, oh my god, it's
reds
so exciting.
Reds and blues, and yeah,
it's
very
dark.
Stark and dark.
Very evil film.
It's the only movie I've ever had to go to the emergency room over, because I thought I was going to stroke out. Because I couldn't get my blood pressure down, and I'd been doing these one scenes, and they were just so dark and twisted, and my mind hasn't dealt with those things before. One morning I woke up and I thought, I'm not going to die. I picked up the phone, called 911.
Wow.
Me and my stormtrooper jammies on the way to the hospital to get checked out.
Well, one thing, speaking of Sienna, one thing I do like is that Sienna does not like to wear jackets for very long. If she has to carry a jacket, more often than not, it's just going to get thrown to the side. I'm like, I'll pick it up later. I'm not going to be bothered to be carrying this right now.
I saw that.
Yes.
You know, it's the end of the world. She's frustrated. You saw what she went through.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, Everything's a bother to her. Everything yeah. is baggage that she can't carry along with her, you know, because she has so much to deal with, you yeah. know. And a lot of that was just happened. A lot of it wasn't planned. It's just that character is just like, you know. And so a lot of that is just the mind space that it comes from. And then he'd have to change another scene because I'd already dumped a jacket, you know.
But if you look closely in the beginning of the film, as she gets into that car, you know, the one with the robot inside
mm-hmm.
it.
Yes.
And she actually finds somebody else's clothing there. Yeah. She wears it later on.
She's a scavenger. Yeah, you know, you got to do what you got to do. Yeah.
And the clothing matches the dog, too, if you look closely, because the dog's black and white. And so yes. it's the little corset thing that she finds later. Yeah. So it's a theme, you know,
and
that black and white.
And it was all planned. The nails were black and white. And then as things start to get a little more mushed up and she's taking on some of these different characteristics, everything goes to silvers and grays yeah, and blacks.
And by the end of the film, you know, she's dressed completely different mm-hmm. and yeah. much more, because she's a new person.
She has a new identity. Yeah. But it's interesting because a lot of that came from, I think, with like some of the color coding and stuff, because I color coded her character when I studied her because of what she knew and what, you know, what she'd, you know, either absorbed or become. And so I had to like separate it out. Okay, this, she doesn't know this, and this, she knows this. And I had to like sort it out, and then that kind of morphed into with costuming and nails and all that. It was hard to keep up with.
Yeah. Well, what I love is just like the attention to detail in terms of the world building, where if you look at the guns, like solar powered guns, which I thought was kind of really cool.
With the voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that was, yeah. Now, it goes back to my little British sci-fi thing, because I was a big Judge Dredd fan. And also mm-hmm. it was a 2080 comic, and also, what was it? That was a comic. I'm trying to think of that. Was it Rogue something?
Rogue Warrior? No,
Rogue Soldier or something?
Yeah, where he's...
You know the comic yes. I mean. And I just, it's Rogue Trooper.
Rogue, yes.
I just realized what I've done. I've ripped on something and I didn't realize that. Because I just love that
sci-fi
comic.
Sci-fi is like that, though. Everybody rips from everybody. You're like, oh, yeah. what a great yeah. idea. You know, or you remember something from your wow. childhood.
But see, that was subconscious. But mm-hmm. I like the fact that this soldier in this post-apocalyptic wasteland spoke to his weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a relationship with them. And I always loved that concept because even, you know, when I was writing as a kid, I had robot friends. You know, kind of like in Silent Running with the two things that walked around. And so I was always about, you know, if you've got a gun, if you've got a robot there, you should have a relationship with them. Because I have a relationship with my truck, you yeah. know. You know, I had to put it to death recently because it blew up. But
you go out on your trucks, though, too. Like, he'll be driving out in his truck and he'll start flirting with other trucks. Oh, that would be such a nice truck yeah. to have. I'm like, you can't go out on your truck.
No.
You got to be loyal.
Yes.
Yeah. So you know, he's always like, oh, I want that one.
but that was my thing. You know, I'm always thinking about how does the gun work? You know, okay, yeah. yes, okay, if you've got this gun and it's got a power pack, okay, you can blow all your power in one shot. That's how she takes down this big robot thing.
Yeah.
You know, she basically says, okay, I'm going to pretty much blow the whole power in one quick shot, but it's going to take down a giant robot. And that's kind of how it worked. You know, that's why I had all those modes for the gun, you know, an armor piercing mode or whatever it was. It was there to show people, okay, the gun has a power supply, it will run out, but if she just has one big shot and it's a perfect shot, she will blow up this giant robot.
And I'd already created relationships with so many things that were
oh, yeah.
objects that it was so easy for me for everything to be alive. You know, yeah. so it was just like, it's like, oh, cool, you know.
It was like with Hoagland.
Yeah, with Hoagland. I mean,
I love that relationship too because it is so, there's so much friction at the beginning of it.
Yeah.
But by the end of it, I mean, there's such a strong relationship
a
built.
Bond.
Yeah, after everything that you've done. And I do like, just put me in the box. I want to be back in my lead box. Just keep
it. Isn't it cute?
Yeah. And but that was became the central story, didn't it?
And it was so important that that relationship be believable. So he let me bring the robot home and put it in my office. And every day for months, I'm like, oh, hey, Hoagland. And people come in, I go, he didn't talk to Hoagland. So he had to be real to me. He had to have a personality. He had to react to things. You know, so it was really kind of interesting when we were on set because somebody else would go to read his lines. I'm like, oh, that's not Hoagland because it was all in here. You know, so then I had to memorize some of Hoagland's lines just because somebody couldn't mess me up. But I truly had a relationship with this robot. I still do. He's in my office. Like, I can't part with him now.
Well, why not? Yes.
Because he had to be that real to me or else I hated watching things when I was young where the robots weren't real to the other characters. And yeah. so it was like, okay, it's got to be real to me. Yeah.
So the actor that did the lines for Hoagland, I came in post. It wasn't there
in
actually
post.
On set. Okay.
He was
and
so
we
happy.
Went through thousands of actors. Everybody thought they'd make the perfect robot voice.
5,000 people.
Yeah, we're going to be in a sci-fi film. And they'd send, and we'd be, just don't do your audition with a robot voice. Of course, they all came in like this. And some of them would do little diagrams, you know, and little robots. And we're like, yeah. you guys aren't getting it. Hoagland's real, you know, and he was really real now. And then Tony Gibbons, my God, he came in. I'm like, that's Hoagland. We're so excited.
How far into the 5,000 auditions did you find Tony?
Last.
Yeah.
Man.
Not joking.
We would have kept going until we found the right voice because you cannot have that not. There's so much to it. There's so much personality. Voice acting's hard. And for Tony, it's so funny because we even dressed the same to opening night without planning it. We both shut up in pink. And we're like, oh, we just a match. But it's just something that he created in his mind at his audition. And Neil directed him in a few little different directions. And it was amazing. It's like, oh, that's how I saw it. It's real now.
Yeah, it's the chemistry, you know. Yeah. And it's a weird chemistry because he's recorded in post. But she created the character in her head. And on screen, but it was so much of what she created on screen then dictated who he had to be. Because they had to be a perfect foil for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of, you know, real scientific discussion between them about what is consciousness and everything else, you know, in the film. And he's just a floating, you know, robot, a little ball.
But I'd even imagined his attitude towards me. And so then we had to have that attitude back. Because in order to have chemistry, it has to go both ways. Mm-hmm. So I just fed myself what his chemistry would be. And it's like, oh man, how are we going to do this?
Yeah.
You know? Tony did it perfectly. Thank you, Tony.
Well, what I love about that is because by the end, you're invested in whether this robot that is just created just in post and everything right there, it survives.
Yeah.
Because he's willing to sacrifice himself to complete this and help Sienna. But you get, I was invested in whether he's going to make it out or not. So well done.
He's got a great future story too, by the way. When we develop the TV series. Mm-hmm. I've got a great place for him to go. I've got a great place for Sienna to go because you don't just want to do part two where it's, you know, running around a planet with a gun. There is a major storyline coming up, which we're still developing, of course, in my head because I write every day. But it's coming up to the point where does Sienna go from here, the character in the film? Because everybody watches the movie, they get to the end. Halfway through, they go, oh, takes a turn. I didn't expect that. You know, and there's that point.
I'd say it's a third of the way through.
Yeah, well, no, there is the other turning. There's a couple of turning points. But
there's
a point where everyone goes, oh, this has become interesting. And then...
Well, they say, this isn't what I thought I was watching. Did you have that experience?
Yes.
Yeah. Where it kind of takes a turn on you. You're like, whoa, we're going on a journey now.
Yeah.
It's not just a sci-fi film anymore. How'd they turn this into a drama?
Yeah. But then where we take it, as I said, you'll see what happens to Sienna. Because now she's this whole new character at the end of the movie. And... it's where we take it and where we take Hoagland because it's, I mean, you know.
Everybody, when they watch the end of the movie, they're like, I want to see what happens next. Like,
yeah.
And we know where it's going.
But it's not what people are expecting, though. Yeah.
Well, you don't want to give them what they expect, for sure.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so exciting, though.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, you know, the film had a big premiere this past Friday night downtown Los Angeles, as you said, the Independent Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you said, the work doesn't stop there. So in terms of Rogue Warrior, what's coming up next?
Well, it's spreading. It has a few more theaters that it's spreading to, so we have to go do a Q&A at the end of, are we in June? Yeah. The end of June in Sutter Creek. It's opening up in a theater up there, so we're going to go up and do a Q&A there, and I think that runs for a couple months. And so it's kind of slowly spreading, and then it comes out in a few days, Walmart, June 6th. It has an exclusive for 60 days, which we're the only independent film in there with the big boys.
Very nice.
So we're very excited. And then August 15th, it goes wide. It's, you can pre-order it on Amazon and I guess wherever else.
Action on Film as well.
We're opening for Action on Film in Las Vegas on August 17th.
Which is a film festival. Cool. We've already played Action.
We already
on
opened
film.
Them last time.
But it's just.
But they asked us to.
Yeah, it was really nice of Dale to actually ask us.
He's a good guy.
You know, to help them, I guess, or help us. I don't know. It helps everybody. And we're doing a big Q&A.
Big talk that day.
Yeah, there's a whole thing on how we really made the movie. After people have seen it, you know, there can be more questions and stuff. So they're making a big deal about it, which is really nice because. You know.
So we just follow the spread. It's going to spread. We're going to spread with it. You know. In the meantime, we've got something else that's in post. And
we're not claiming this movie is the greatest thing in the planet. It's the small film that wanted to be something more than just a small film. And we're just doing our best to try to make it, you know, something else. Because it's, you know, it's a labor of love and passion. And I mean,
and for every actor, too. I would say every actor in that, like, just really gave us their...
Yeah,
they're 110%.
William Kircher was just amazing. He was
brilliant.
He was one of the.
He's the main dwarf in the Hobbit trilogy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Dr. Johnson in the film, and then Stephen Manley and Daz Crawford. I mean, just everybody really gave it their all, and they were just really all about the project. I mean, to give you a funny story, when we first premiered at Action on Film, because we knew we were getting a bunch of awards there and stuff like that, everybody's spread out. We're in 5 states and 3 countries, right? The whole cast all came back. And then for opening night, too, everybody's spread out all over. It's like, ah, we're opening June 2nd. They all come back. You know, and it's we don't have the budget to do that for them.
Yeah.
But that's how invested they are in the character and the film and everything else. And it's just, it's brilliant.
And all they ever do is privately just pull me aside and say, when's the series? We want to do the TV series.
They just want to keep creating because that's the kind of actor that they are.
That's the kind of people that, well, I think they, the actors, but also just the atmosphere on set, too. If you have that, and it starts there from you, Neil. I mean, it's your idea, but you're able to just foster the sense of camaraderie.
We have fun.
We do.
And that's what we, you know, and that's, Tracy works harder than any other actor I've ever worked with. And I worked with some amazingly high level good actors. But she's just this machine.
I'm ridiculous.
And so that kind of brings all the other actors up. It's either you step in and follow her, or you just go away and die.
Somebody showed up one day in the beginning during principal photography with their script in their hand. And I gave them, I'm like, you don't show.
I don't know who
I'm
that,
not
you
saying
can't
who
say
it
who
is.
That was.
I'm
I
not,
don't know
I'm
it
not.
Is.
It was like, and they were, and they, I'm not even going to use a he or she.
Yep.
And they were like, well, I was da-da-da late last night. I'm like, you had to be off this months ago. You can't just show up with that in your hand, you know? I mean, because these people are, if you're living something, you can't go back and refer to something, you know? Yeah. So anyway, that was the only time that happened. But it was like, I was just in such shock. You know, it's one thing for the director to have. The director's got to see, you know, what's going on and da-da-da and set up the shot. But the cast shouldn't.
Well, you've already you collaborated before this with doing some VOs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And now you've done Rogue Warrior. And you're also doing Time War as well. So what is it about the two of you that you enjoy so much about working with each other?
I know the
dedication
answer.
Dedication to the craft.
We're workaholics.
We work harder than other people that we're used to being around, and it's exciting because you work with all these people that say how hard they work, and that say this, that, and the other thing, but when you actually see it in somebody else, it helps you move forward if you have more than one person. I mean, and we're slowly kind of developing a team of people that are that psycho about it, shall I say?
It's not just us. We just happen to be the two figureheads,
the faces,
and Tracy and I rarely disagree on anything, which it's kind of odd, but you know, I don't mind the disagreements. I like having creative discussions and arguments. It's important that you feel something, but we generally seem to be in the same headspace most of the time, which is nice.
And a lot of, like, if I have an opinion on something, a lot of times I'll put it in writing and be like, okay, take it or don't take it, but here's my opinion.
Yeah, actually, we're going through that right now. I said, look, I finally let her watch the film.
And I think I have like 17 pages
the
of notes.
The 4-hour version of the movie. And I was, and you know, she finally watched it. And now I've got all these pages to look through. And it's like, oh boy.
And they're very, very specific.
So we may not like each other in a week's time.
But that way he can make his own decisions. It's his film.
Yeah.
I'm just an actress and a producer, you know. But it's like, I went through it line by line. You know, it's like I have to believe everything somebody's saying. I have to never see theatrics. I hate theatrics. And you just got to feel it. You got to believe it. And I hate anything unnecessary. I hate anything getting said that you already see. Mm-hmm. You know? You probably didn't see much of that in Rogue Warrior,
no,
did you?
No, not at all. No, which is nice. All right.
It is nice, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I do like that. And it's one of the things that you mentioned. You realize, that's true. Mm-hmm. And but as you're watching, you're just enjoying it for the experience that it is. But when you look back and you're like, you're right, that is true.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was at the screening, you know, because we had like I always liked Daz Crawford's reaction.
This was awesome.
He was in Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Blade 2 and James Bond. He's, you know, he's a seasoned actor.
Now we're talking about the first screening here.
Okay.
Yeah, the first screening, he was like, he couldn't speak.
He was gobsmacked.
He was gobsmacked.
His jaw was... Because all he knew was the script and what happened during that couple of weeks that he was there. But he had no idea that it was going to turn into this big of a...
The weird thing was, the second time, both he and William Kircher saw the film, said, oh, you changed a few things. I said, no, I haven't changed a thing. There's more in this movie than you realize.
Stevie said that too.
Yeah, everyone thinks we've changed stuff. It's been sitting exactly the same.
Because you have to go watch it again. There's so many layers in there that I don't think you can catch them the first time through.
And they keep saying, well, you've done this and you've done that. No, that was there originally. It's just, it's too much. There's too much information. And it's a sort of, my movies are always the sort of movies that with repeat viewing, there's little extra things. And there's always something extra inside it, which I like to do because I like those movies. You know, I'll watch Interstellar 20 times or mm-hmm. Prometheus or anything. And I like the layers in Prometheus that are hidden.
Yeah.
Because few mm-hmm. people get it. You know, Prometheus is this, it's an amazing movie, but you've got to be a director who's willing to put those layers in. And I could watch a Stanley Kubrick movie maybe 1,000 times. And Eyes Wide Shut is another example. That movie for me gets better every time I watch it. It was so, you know, it was
That's
panned
why
by the critics.
Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
like
Clockwork Orange.
I can watch
Orange.
That over and over and I see something new. But didn't you, at some point when you watched it, be like, oh, I wish I would have known that sooner, than that would have made sense to me. But then you wouldn't know the journey.
That's true.
But now you'd want to go back and watch it knowing what's going to happen.
Yes.
Because you'll see so much more.
You understand, like, you know, where Sienna is at the end of the film. Like, oh, okay, that's going to, yeah. I understand some of these things that you're alluding to at the beginning. It's going to reward that, which is nice. You want to see a film that holds up to repeated viewing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's always new things to discover along the way, which is really cool. Mm. I don't know if I agree with you on Prometheus, Daniel. I mean, I love the film. I still will keep going back to watch it, but it also is beautiful.
I know what annoys you about it.
Yeah. Okay.
But see, now this is the thing. Yeah, I get that criticism. But you see, for me, it's just guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Once you look past those things, it's like, okay, I know that's a bit weird why the biologist would do that with the creature in front of his face. But it's still, you know, I get so much pleasure from other things in that movie. It just outshines all of that. I mean, I love Star Wars Episode 2 and 3 heavily. And 1 I like, you know, quite a bit. But I'm Revenge of the Sith, I could watch that maybe 1,000 times and never get sick of it because, you know, I know the faults. Mm-hmm. But oh my god, the moments when it's glorious and it's just happening, and you know Anakin's burning, and you know, or you know the Emperor's going no. I can't stop watching that moment. It's like I'm just fascinated with that.
I remember
that.
You kept having me watch all that Emperor stuff before we shut the timer because I have this one. I play like 20 different versions as time travel, right? And it's really, really complicated because they all have to be different for it to be believable. And he kept making me watch that scene, you know, he's like over and over and over. And I'm like trying to get into that mindset.
The scene when they're, you know, they're in the opera, which everyone hates that scene. I love it.
I love that scene.
The way he speaks, the actor is so good.
So poetic.
You know?
But so dark.
Have you ever told
so
you the
twisted.
Script?
So twisted.
You know, Darth Plagueis. And it's just like, oh, I just got to, it's like a great song. Mm-hmm. You just want to hear that song over and over again and get into it. You know what I mean? Everyone's been too critical. Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean, he's just living that moment, you know? So you can be critical of that because you feel like you're watching a conversation that's being poetic. But at the same time, that's some of the things that some of us just strive on, you know. Yeah. We don't want to see people act.
No, you want to just see people
you just want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to say, as we're wrapping up, I enjoy Rogue Warrior, Robot Fighter, but Time War, man, I am a huge time travel junkie. So
you're in for a treat.
So
I cannot wait. Oh, so please, 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 please come back to talk about Time War because I would be jazzed to go down a time travel rabbit hole with you guys.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. And you dug your hand through bear poop.
There you go.
So look at that.
Yeah.
That's right. So I'm not shy.
I'm a time tomboy.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guests have been Tracy Birdsall and director and writer of Rogue Warrior Robot Fighter, Neil Johnson. So you feel free to check it out there. It's going to be going in a few more theaters, eventually going to Walmart there for its 60 days.
60 days.
And then opening to other avenues on August 15th.
Yes.
Oh, yes. So ladies and gentlemen, I've been your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. And if you, I'd happy to go Jackie. And if you want to continue following with you guys, all your updates, whether it be Rogue Warrior, Time War, where's the best place to find you online?
Twitter, I'm Tracy Birdsall 1. Facebook, I'm Tracy Birdsall Official. Instagram, Tracy Birdsall 1, or TracyBirdsall.com will point you to everywhere else.
I love it.
Yeah.
And for me, www.empire.com, empire.com, and follow the links from there to all the social stuff.
Oh, all right. So, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you check out Rogue Warrior Robot Fighter. It's a great time. You'll really enjoy it. And be on the lookout for Time War. I can't wait for this one myself. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll catch you next time here for another guest on iTalk Movies. See you later.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.